This podcast is brought to you by the Everything Nut Allergy Cookbook, available now wherever books are sold. Details at foodallergypi.com. Welcome to the Food Allergy Talk podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI. The topics covered in this podcast are not medical advice and are simply the opinions and views of both myself and those interviewed. While you will hear me make mention of my holistic nutrition certification, you should know that this is not a medical license and you should always consult a licensed board certified allergist. I'm Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI, host of Food Allergy Talk. I'm a holistic nutritionist, cookbook author, food allergy community advocate, and blogger. I'm married with 5 children, ages 4, 6, 9, 11, and 14. My oldest, Stetson, is the only one of my 5 children with food allergies, anaphylactic to peanut and shellfish since he was a baby. Then, recently this year, he was additionally diagnosed with anaphylactic allergies to pecan, walnut, oats, garlic, which by the way has been the hardest and worst of all of them, it's in everything, sweet potato, watermelon, and pear. We live in southeastern Arizona, where I homeschool all 5 of our children. I got involved in the food allergy community through support, outreach, and fundraising in 2009, following Stetson's first anaphylactic reaction. Later, in 2012, I initiated legislation to allow for stock epinephrine to be available for all students in Arizona schools. This was passed into law later in 2013. In 2018, I began focusing my energy on reaching out to the food allergy community through my blog, Food Allergy PI, because isn't that what we all are? When we are caring for others or ourselves have food allergies, we're detectives, we're investigators. On Food Allergy PI, I share my own experience caring for food allergies, travel, dining out, product finds, and recipe creation. Most recently, in 2021, I authored the Everything Nut Allergy Cookbook. Now, I have created the Food Allergy Talk podcast as a way to continue building community and helping others in the food allergy community. My goal is to help you not only learn from my journey and those interviewed here on the Food Allergy Talk podcast, but to grow and gain confidence in all facets of living a full, whole life with food allergy, body, mind, and spirit. Health, safety, social, emotional, and spiritual well-being, all of which are impacted by living with food allergies, as well as for those caring for others with food allergies. This is Food Allergy Talk, where you can come to connect and leave uplifted, empowered, and ready for success. Welcome back to the Food Allergy Talk podcast. If you're living it or have a question about it, we are talking about it. I'm your host, Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI. On this episode of Food Allergy Talk, I welcome Claire Baker, Senior Communications Director at Beyond Celiac, the leading celiac disease advocacy organization in the United States. Claire was diagnosed with celiac herself in 2010. Her symptoms, which included long-term severe anemia, GI problems, brain fog, and more, revealed that she may have gone undiagnosed for decades. Today, we will discuss with Claire celiac disease, what it is, what are the symptoms to look for, how do you get diagnosed, how do you manage living a life with celiac disease, as well as Beyond Celiac, the organization, and their role in the celiac community. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. There are, I know, so many family and friends that have celiac disease. They've either been managing it for years or they're recently diagnosed. There's also several individuals, and this is really why I wanted to have you on, is because this is a food allergy podcast. So many in the food allergy community also happen to have celiac. And so this is a great way to, you know, kind of direct them to another resource, whereas there's many food allergy, organizations and resources to kind of point them in a direction for some other things that they might be dealing with.
Well, always happy to help and get the information out. You know, it seems like, and I'm sure you know, as an activist in the food allergy realm, the more you talk about it, the more you find people who say, "Oh yeah, me too." And having the conversation and getting the word out just educates everyone, and you know, all our boats rise together. I probably got that analogy a little bit wrong, but you know.
No, but you're so right. And it's an invisible situation that we're dealing with, whether it's food allergies or it's celiac. Until you talk about it, like you mentioned, you don't realize how many around you are quietly dealing with the same thing.
Exactly.
Now, you know, we'll just jump right into it. What are some of the symptoms? What exactly is celiac disease? As a lot of people I hear oftentimes confuse it with an allergy, and it's not an allergy.
It's not an allergy. And it's funny that you say that. A lot of people with celiac disease, just to say, note it right off the bat, they will tell a server in the restaurant that it is an allergy because they think people understand allergies better than an autoimmune disease. So if they, even people who know the difference between an autoimmune disease and an allergy will explain it as an allergy because they think people understand that better and think it will be taken a little bit more seriously. But we know that that you know allergies are and autoimmune diseases are different animals, though they do have a lot of overlapping characteristics in some ways. So celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, and it's triggered when a person who has it consumes gluten, which is the protein in wheat, rye, and barley. And, you know, with an autoimmune disease, your immune system misfires and attacks a body system instead of, you know, a foreign invader. And in the case of celiac disease, it attacks the lining of the small intestine. And so the lining of the small intestine is filled with these finger-like projections called villi. They actually give your small intestine all of that surface area by which we absorb food. And the immune system attacks the lining, flattening those villi so that it eliminates a lot of the surface area that absorbs nutrients. And so then the outcome are nutritional deficiencies. There's a lot of systemic inflammation. The symptoms can vary. Some people don't have any symptoms, or they don't realize they have any symptoms until maybe later. I was one of those people who thought I'm fine. I'm okay. And then I got diagnosed because of anemia. Anemia is, my body wasn't absorbing the nutritional iron that I was taking in. And so, you know, I got diagnosed because of anemia, went gluten-free, and then I felt much better and didn't realize that the gas and bloating and the, you know, intermittent unexplained diarrhea and my canker sores and all of those things were all related to celiac disease or gluten consumption. So I just thought that's just the way life is, and we all sort of feel crappy all the time. So I didn't realize I was symptomatic. But to get back to the question of what are some of the symptoms, what we think of as the typical symptoms are all GI related, like diarrhea and gas and bloating, even constipation, things of the GI tract, which kind of makes sense if the damage is being done to your small intestine. But there are a whole host of symptoms that are not related at all, or don't seem to be related at all to the GI tract. It's full body, you know, systemic sort of thing. So could be headaches, nutritional challenges like anemia or vitamin D deficiency could cause, you know, tooth enamel problems. There's a specific skin rash called dermatitis herpetiformis, which is specific to people with celiac disease. It's sort of the skin manifestation of celiac disease, but it really just looks like an itchy skin rash that gets misdiagnosed as, you know, atopic dermatitis or something like that. And we are learning more and more about the neurological symptoms of celiac disease, things like brain fog, headaches, balance problems, even, you know, depression, anxiety. Those things are all showing up in the literature as being connected to undiagnosed, untreated celiac disease.
Wow.
And I could see how it would be so easy for so many people to go undiagnosed because, like you mentioned, you might just think, oh, I have a canker sore. Great. You know, and then you go through and then the next day you got a little bit of a loose stool or whatever. Oh, I must've ate something bad, but not really thinking, you know, I've got celiac.
Exactly.
And then the next day you got a rash and you're just like, man, I just can't catch a break here, thinking that you're just having getting older and, or whatever, right?
Right. Because on the face of it, why would you think those things are necessarily connected? Why would I have thought that my anemia was related to canker sores? I thought canker sores were a virus. I thought they were just cold sores inside your mouth.
Right.
No, they're an autoimmune disease. They're a separate autoimmune disease, but you know, with autoimmune diseases, when you have one, you tend to get others. They sort of travel as fun friends, you know.
Yeah. And I think, right. And I think that's why oftentimes you will find people that have celiac and food allergies, mm-hmm. or celiac and something else. Right. Now, yeah. I have a question. Am I pronouncing it right? Is it villi?
Villi. Yeah.
Do they grow back?
They do get better. So you go, you get diagnosed, you go gluten-free, and you have to be very strict about it. You know, it's your body will, can re-trigger an autoimmune reaction without a whole lot of provocation. So it's really a strict gluten-free diet. But your small intestine will get better. The interesting thing that's coming out of research that we're seeing, and even research that Beyond Celiac is funding, is that while it's your villi are repairing themselves and getting better, they're not necessarily reconstructing themselves in quite the same way. And your microbiome appears to be forever changed. So that's I'll feel a lot better, but what do you mean? It's sort of like the analogy I used is scar tissue. You know, imagine that the lining of the small intestine had just been severely wounded. And then when it came back together, it was, you know, yay, you're all healed up, but it's not quite like it was before. And we're still, research is still sorting out what that means and what are the long-term ramifications for people with celiac disease, even those of us who are on a strict gluten-free diet. So yes, we feel much better, but there are still things that we're going to have to pay attention to.
And I've heard the term brain fog often regarding several different things. But some people might be listening and they're not quite sure. Well, you know, it kind of seems self-explanatory. Like maybe I'm just, my brain's not quite awake, kind of like maybe how some people might feel if they haven't had caffeine. How would you describe that? If somebody's like, do I have brain fog?
That's a great question. And that comes up for people with gluten sensitivity also. So gluten sensitivity is, it's got many of the symptoms of celiac disease, but doesn't have the damage to the small intestine. So, and people with gluten sensitivity and celiac disease are both prone to brain fog, which is just a lack of clarity in being able to think and focus. When I was experiencing it, I remember as the job I had before I got diagnosed with celiac disease and later came to work at Beyond Celiac, I would come back from lunch and I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't get through my work. I couldn't do anything. I remember having a conversation with a friend saying, I think there's something terribly wrong with me. I think maybe I've got early onset dementia. I was like, I think something's, and I, you know, I'm at work. I can't really tell my boss that I can't work. You know, it's like, I'm here, I'm physically here, but I cannot get through this. You know, I was a program manager at a nonprofit. I just couldn't do it. So it was a lack of ability to concentrate, lack of ability to just, you know, do what I would do if I just hadn't had a big gluten-y lunch, apparently.
Right. And so there could even be kids at school, for example. And, you know, as a parent myself, I might be thinking, come on, Susie, or, you know, whatever their name is, like, you just got to focus. But
exactly.
Maybe consider that it could be something else and they're not trying to not pay attention. You know, could be something else.
That's right. There's a story that is live this week in Psychology Today. Becky Diamond is the author and she wrote this. It's a, you know, first person story about her son having undiagnosed celiac disease as a really little boy. And all of the teachers were accusing Becky, the writer, of just bad parenting. You just don't, you're just not holding, you're just not being consistent. You're not, you're not strict enough. You're not, you're not enough. It's your fault, mom, that your son, and because his primary presenting symptom was all neurological, all, brain fog, his sunny disposition disappeared, finally got diagnosed, went gluten-free, and, her boy is back, but she's letting the world know that, hey, we've got to look out for this, and we can't just dismiss challenges that kids are facing or adults are facing as, you just don't want to, you're just misbehaving. You're just, bad in some way rather than, something else is going on. Nobody wants to be painted in a box of, you don't want it. You're not good enough. So,
say somebody's listening to this and they're like, okay, well, I think I've had all of those things that she's mentioning in the symptoms and maybe some more things on top of that. How do you get diagnosed? I know that my husband and my son, because they both actually have multiple food allergies, but some of the symptoms, when it's not presenting as immediate anaphylaxis, sometimes it can be kind of tricky. And until you visit a primary care physician and an allergist and other people, you might oftentimes these diseases, if you will, or autoimmune issues can mimic each other. And then I've heard that you can get like a false positive or a false negative if you're eating gluten or not eating gluten.
Yeah, it's true. There is a blood test. So if you suspect you have celiac disease, the first step is to have a blood test, and it's the IgA TTG test, which, mostly you would say to your doctor or your healthcare provider, the celiac disease panel. It's a collection of tests. And if those come back positive, then your doctor would order a endoscopy with a biopsy. Your knowledgeable doctor, probably not sure every, I can't speak for all doctors, but if your doctor is knowledgeable, the next step then would be an endoscopy with a biopsy. And an endoscopy is, run a scope down the top half of you, an upper GI, one might call it. And then they take a little snip from multiple locations in the top part of your small intestine called the duodenum or duodenum. It's an arm wrestling match with which one you call it. Take some snips from the top part of your small intestine. They send them back to a lab to look and see how your villi are doing. Are your villi nice and fluffy, or are they blunted, or are they flat? And then if there's damage to your small intestine, then that's the gold standard for a diagnosis for celiac disease. There is some research that says a low test result for the blood test doesn't mean you don't have celiac disease, but frequently doctors won't prescribe the endoscopy and biopsy after that unless there are other compelling symptoms, something that really just says, no, I really think this is going to be celiac disease. Let's do that upper endoscopy. And that's where we need more research. It's really interesting to see that there are people with celiac disease out there whose blood test didn't necessarily prompt that next step. So that's something to look for. Celiac disease does have a genetic component, and you can do a genetic test to see if you have the genes for celiac disease. However, 40% of the population have one or both of the genes for celiac disease. So it can rule out celiac disease. If you come back and you don't have that gene, either of those genes, then you can pretty much rule out celiac disease. But if you have one of them, it doesn't necessarily mean you have it. 40% of the population have one or both of these genes, but really only about 1% of the population goes on to develop celiac disease. So the gene test is helpful, but not conclusive. Really the conclusive test is that endoscopy and biopsy right now.
And can someone tell if they have celiac with the blood test alone, or do they say they have really high numbers, just super high numbers on this blood test celiac disease panel? Is it common to have such high numbers, but then?
More and more doctors are really looking at that. And in Europe, for pediatrics, if a child has really high blood test numbers, they will, and other risk factors, they'll just declare it to be celiac disease without the endoscopy and biopsy.
For a child, that can be kind of invasive.
Yeah. I mean, and there's not a lot of good explanations for why those numbers would be super high, you know? So if you've got, and if somebody's testing, I won't say that it could be that a kid lucked into the blood panel without a bunch of symptoms, but imagining that, you know, there's something up where we just don't know what's wrong with my kid. Let's do that test. Wow. Those numbers are really high. You know, in Europe, they've set a new standard that says, you know, above this threshold, we'll just say it's celiac disease without the biopsy. And in the United States, we're not there yet, but as procedures go, the endoscopy and biopsy, while it is invasive, it's not super scary. That's my technical term for that is not super scary.
Right. And then you can get the help that you need by having a more definitive answer.
And that's such a good point. Part of the challenge is that if you stop eating gluten, let me see if I feel better. You know, I've heard a lot about gluten. I heard that great podcast just the other day. Maybe I'll stop eating gluten and see if I feel better. Oh, I do. If you stay off gluten for very long, those antibodies that you're testing for when you take those blood tests, they'll return to normal. And so the blood test will be not useful. It won't give you any information about whether or not you have celiac disease. So then you're kind of in this limbo of, do I maintain a gluten-free diet because I think I have celiac disease, but it's not diagnosed? Or was that just, you know, can I go back on gluten now that I feel better and maybe it won't be a big deal? So we always recommend get tested before you go 100% gluten-free or your tests won't reveal anything.
That's very helpful to know, because I know even when we went in, my son, very long story short, when he was a baby, he was diagnosed with peanut and shellfish anaphylactic food allergies. And he's now 14. We went for over a decade thinking that's all he would ever have. And then he started presenting with lots of different symptoms. And, you know, of course we went on Google like people do, even though they tell you not to. And we were trying, you know, and we were kind of thinking he might have celiac or IBS. I mean, there was just lots of different things we were thinking. Anyway, we ended up finding he did actually have 7 new food allergies, unfortunately. But one of the things they did was a celiac panel. And it is just so important to make sure that you get that right diagnosis from whether it's a board certified allergist, or as you mentioned earlier, a doctor that really does know their stuff, and that they're very familiar with whether it be celiac or other things, before you just go start willy-nilly taking things out of your diet and trying to self-diagnose and self-help in that way.
Yeah. And I, there are a lot of people who have done this, you know, they're in this boat now of I've gone gluten-free. I never really got a definitive diagnosis. And so, if ever a treatment for celiac disease does come along, I don't even know if I will qualify, you know, I don't know if I'm, so I'm stuck. I guess I could do a gluten challenge, which means go back on gluten for a while. Run the risk of feeling terrible. And frankly, I've got diagnosed 12 years ago. When I get accidentally glutened now, I get ridiculously sick, way sicker than I ever did. It's not like I just resume like, oh, I feel mildly brain foggy and I have some gas and bloating. No, I'm out for at least half a day immediately. You know, 2 hours later, within an hour, I can go, oh, darn it. I know I ate the wrong thing. And, you know, 2.5 hours in, I'm incapacitated for the next 6 hours. So, I couldn't do a gluten challenge. I couldn't do a gluten challenge. I just physically, I wouldn't be unable to, because I would be so sick and there's just no way I could do it. So, so these people, you know, the people who've gone gluten-free, without the test are a little bit, you know, they're kind of caught until another test comes along, and those are in development also. You know, one nice thing about the advancement in clinical trials is that the researchers also need to be able to get a better sense of how quickly people are reacting if they've got a a gluten challenge, you know, if a clinical trial requires a gluten challenge, let's come up with a different test that doesn't involve an endoscopy and biopsy. How quickly can we tell if somebody's reacting to gluten? So there are progress is being made, but it always seems it seems like it's coming fast, and yet it seems like it's taking forever. So
right, and that I can relate to when you talk about going without the gluten for a long period of time. And for anybody that's listening that's familiar with food allergies and OIT, oral immunotherapy, so a lot of the ways that some people have looked into treating food allergies, for example, is by taking daily doses of their allergen to kind of build up a tolerance. And so I guess you could look at it that way. If you have been eating gluten, and you're constantly have the brain fog and other issues, and you haven't worked to get it out of your diet, in a way, you've, from what I'm understanding, and do correct me if I'm wrong, you've kind of built up a tolerance, if you will. But then when you go to heal yourself and you've now removed it from your diet, that quote unquote tolerance, and maybe that's not the right word, is gone. So then any little bit that you get is really going to affect you. Is that kind of what
I'm not certain about the science behind it. Mm-hmm. That is definitely my experience of it and the experience of our community. So we survey our community, and many people note that their symptoms are much worse if they get gluten after they've gone gluten free. And so it does seem to make sense that, you know, if you're eating it all along, if you're eating gluten all along, like I was up until 2010, and just feeling kind of randomly not so good. And, you know, I did have a progression of symptoms, but nothing like I get now. Then my body is free from a substance that my immune system misfires on. I reintroduce it. It's like poison. It's, right. I mean, to me it is. And I won't say, you know, my experience is not the same as everyone with celiac disease. So this is that it's another very interesting thing we see in our community. We have a really large following through email and social media and that sort of thing. And, you know, each individual person's experience is their experience, you know, and we might share some characteristics, but it's part of the work of Beyond Celiac is in addition to educating the world about celiac disease, educating our own community about the variability of celiac disease within our own population. Some people, some people can tolerate 5 parts per million gluten. You know, the legal, the FDA guideline for what can be labeled gluten-free is 20 parts per million or less. Some people can't tolerate 19 parts per million. Some people can, you know, it's like, so some people get sick when they look at a photo of gluten, walk through a bakery, you know, they yeah. get sick. And, you know, other people will say, you can't possibly get sick that fast. I'm over here. I have celiac disease. That doesn't make me sick. And the answer is you're different people and your systems are different. And you both have celiac disease that, you know, is expressed in different ways. So one person's story is one person's story. What we have in common is that we have damage to our small intestine and that gluten is the culprit. And it's the only autoimmune disease that has a known trigger like that, which puts celiac disease research on the forefront of solving autoimmune disease. You know, if we can get to the root of what's triggering the body to misfire in the presence of gluten, which is not, it's not inherently an evil particle, you know,
right.
Plenty of people eat bread, pizza, pasta, cookies, crackers, and don't, you know, get terribly ill. You know, if we can solve that, then we're really going to have a leg up on solving the other autoimmune diseases. 50 million Americans are living with autoimmune disease and, you know, MS and rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and so many people are suffering out there. If we can move it along, you know, there's hope out there. And that's, it's exciting to be part of that work.
And I think that so many in the food allergy community, as you're saying that, are clapping and saying, yes, yes, you get it, because the same is true for those with food allergy. And that's something that we can, whereas celiac disease and food allergy can be so completely different in many ways, that's something that we can relate with. Whereas my son, for example, he's so severely allergic to peanuts that he can't even eat regular M&Ms because of the may contain and cross contact. Whereas I have a niece that she goes and she eats peanut oil at, you know, Chick-fil-A, and she eats the regular M&Ms and she eats all these things. And then I have family members that are confused and they're like, well, she's just eating it just fine. Why can't your son just eat those things just fine? Maybe you're exaggerating. You know what I mean? And that's where it goes back to that whole thing, similar to celiac, where we can kind of relate in that way and maybe help work together to build more awareness about whether it's celiac, whether it's food allergy, whether it's other autoimmune diseases. And I think people that maybe my husband, for example, that has fibromyalgia, when we start looking at all of these different things that people deal with, to realize that those things are not the same for everyone. They are different for everyone. And just because they're different, it doesn't mean that one person's is easier or not real or exaggerated or anything else.
Very true. And we are in the same boat in terms of, you know, just trying to get people to take us seriously, mm-hmm. Acknowledging that, we're not kidding when we say we can't have that. We can't eat that. Oh, just a little, that won't hurt. And probably in the allergy world, well, will you have a anaphylactic response? It's like, well, how sick do I have to be for you to take this seriously?
And cross contact does affect celiac as well, right?
Absolutely. It certainly does. And it comes up mostly, it creates the biggest challenge for our community in dining out, socializing, and travel. You know, it's probably the same for the allergy community, that when you try to go to a party, when you hop on an airplane, or go to another city, or you try to go to a restaurant, it's the, can I have this? Are they going to get it? Are they going to understand? Do they know what I'm talking about? And you know, you go to a restaurant and say, hey, I I'll just come right out. I have celiac disease. I can't have any gluten. And if the response is something like, oh, there's no glucose in that, I'll go, yeah, you don't know what you're doing, and I'm not going to eat here. You know, it's like, exactly. I won't. That's like, wow, I'll have a salad, nothing on, give me some lettuce. And usually that's safe. Although I have found the hidden crouton at the bottom of the salad. I'm like, come on,
right.
Doggone it. But, so that's the, you know, trying to live life normally. And we don't want to sound like we're, oh, woe is me. You know,
right.
We don't. And that, I think that's part of the challenge too, especially in the work that we do in fundraising and trying to raise awareness. People who have been diagnosed for a while are like, well, I'm not that sick. I'm managing pretty well. It's okay. Like, no. I'm like, yes, that's true. But then if we talk a little bit more, we'll hear your story about how you missed the wedding because you got glutened at breakfast, or I think it was my 50th birthday. I had tickets to Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Scarlett Johansson on Broadway and got glutened at dinner and spent the entire show barfing in the bathroom. It's like, wow. You know, so, you know, yeah, it could be worse. It could be worse, but we all, our communities deserve to be able to live life to the fullest. And until we get to a place of, there's never going to be a completely gluten-free world, and there's never going to be a completely allergen-free world, because so many people in the world don't have that problem. So we've got to come up with other solutions.
Absolutely. And just to backtrack a little bit, I know that as you were speaking, a thought came to me. I think it can be very confusing for people, even those that are most well-intended, to try and be helpful to somebody that they know that has celiac and they want to invite them over for dinner, or have their kid that has celiac over to for a play date with their kid, you know, and they want to well-intentioned give them a gluten-free fruit nut snack or something, right? You mentioned wheat, rye, and barley, or did I?
Yeah, that's
one. Mm-hmm. I've seen different things, and I haven't paid a whole lot of attention, because I kind of focus more on food allergy, of course. But I want to say that I've seen people even say, for example, like Rice Krispie treats aren't really gluten-free, or there can be, how do you read labels? Like, how do you really know what's gluten-free? For if you were to kind of, you know, layman's terms for just people to kind of learn a little bit more about helping those with celiac, or even they themselves, if they're getting a new diet, how do you read the label? How do you know what is gluten-free and what's not? It's not as straightforward, I think, as some people. You don't just look for wheat.
You're right. It is not as straightforward as you think. You get diagnosed with celiac disease, and I called it the year of freaking out. I've coined the phrase, if you hear it again, it came from me, the year of freaking out, because it's just in so gluten is in more things than you would think. And Rice Krispie Treats is a great example. Regular Kellogg's Rice Krispies has malt in it, which is a barley product. So, and barley, as you know, it's not a top 9 allergen. It doesn't have to be declared on a food label. So you have to become, you know, good at reading labels. And if you see barley, or if you see malt and it doesn't tell you its origin, probably it's barley. It might be rice barley. I mean, rice malt, but that's not very typical. And we know in Rice Krispies, you know, because we know it's barley. So, wheat has to be declared on a package label. Anything that says malt, unless it is clear that it's not a barley product, and some food manufacturers are very good about noting that. That's one to watch out for. Rye doesn't actually come up that much unless you're eating rye bread. You know, rye is just not a grain that's out there that much, but you have to watch for that on the label. The gluten-free, if a package is labeled gluten-free, it is a voluntary label. I said that funny, like I'm from elsewhere. It's a voluntary label, but if they make that claim, it has to test at or below 20 parts per million of gluten. So, and lawyers get involved, I think, in these labeling. So something can be labeled gluten-free and also have that processed in a plant that also does wheat or whatever. That's a CYA statement. If it's labeled gluten-free, you should be able to trust that it's gluten-free. And if you have a reaction that you think is a gluten reaction to something that's labeled gluten-free, then there's a process to report it to the FDA. I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of effort to track down the culprits, but if the FDA sees a trend in a product, a lot of complaints coming in that it's labeled gluten-free and a lot of people are getting sick, then they should investigate, and we will encourage them to do that. But if it's something's labeled gluten-free, you should be able to trust it. There are a lot of certifying agencies out there. We Beyond Celiac endorses the gluten-free certification program, which is also the same one that's used in Canada, and it's run by a company in England. So it's got a big European presence as well. So, restaurant meals are different. So the challenge in restaurants is that people have coined the phrase gluten-friendly, which mostly means they have some things on the menu that don't have gluten in the ingredients, but they're not making any promises that they won't rub gluten all over it in the kitchen. I jest a little bit.
Or use the same spatula or the same knife.
Right. And for some people that's okay. That's good enough. Because they don't have celiac disease. Maybe they are gluten sensitive and, just, you know, staying mostly clear of it won't make them ill. But if you have celiac disease, you really do have to, set forth some expectations at the restaurant that they be very careful. And I do that. I was like, I have celiac disease. I need you to follow all of your safe gluten-free food handling procedures. They say, okay. And I'll deputize the wait staff. I need your help. I will get really sick if, and they're like, okay, okay. And they'll take it seriously. I've even had wait staff say, yeah, you don't want to eat here. Like they will lower their voice and like tell me behind their hand. Yeah. I've got a friend who's got celiac disease and I don't think I would have them eat here. And I'm like, well, okay, thanks.
And it's kind of a bummer, but then it's like, okay, thank you. Because now we won't get sick.
Right. Exactly.
Thanks for being honest with me.
Yeah. And that same server at that one, like, oh, I could give you the edamame because I make that, you know, she's like, right. It's like, so I can offer you something the true story. It happened just like that. I'm like, I like edamame.
Yeah.
Okay. Bring me some.
Now, what are some surprise places that you've, or whether it's food or ingredients or dishes, that you have found gluten that people may like not be aware of?
I think, soy sauce is one that I wouldn't have thought of. It's, most regular soy sauce in the United States has wheat in it as a component. There are others. There's tamari and there's also gluten-free soy sauce. So you can you can have a, you can sub something else in, but don't trust the soy sauce. Cross contact in fryers. Like if you, potatoes, fried potato, you know, French fries, that should be all right. Well, if you're, if the restaurant also fries their breaded and battered goods in the same fryer, that oil is not safe for you. You can't really have your French fries there. Some places claim that they have dedicated fryers, and that's great. I've got zero affiliation, but you know, Five Guys is a burger restaurant here in the East Coast, and they don't do. I trust their our fries are gluten free, and it's a dedicated fryer because they don't have anything on the menu that's breaded and fried. They do burgers and fries, so the only thing going in the fryer well, are fries. I'm like, okay, I can believe that. Yeah, but if it's a place that also has those you know chicken sandwich or whatever, or chicken nuggets, I'll say no thanks.
And that's how we are with In-N-Out here on the West Coast. They have such a simple menu that's one safe place that we feel that we can go to eat. For example, with French fries, there's nothing else that they fry there. I would check as far as gluten goes, but I can relate to that when it comes to peanut allergy, or my son also has a shellfish allergy. So then you also have in the fryer shrimp or, you know, different things.
Well, yeah, you know, and even McDonald's fries have some sort of additive that's got gluten in it. Even if I trusted the fryers at McDonald's, their fries have an ingredient in it that make them not okay for me to eat. So you can't just assume it's French fries. That's just a potato. Well,
not necessarily.
What else do you put on that? Seasoning blends may or may not contain a gluten containing thing. I found tea that has barley in it. You know, it's sleepy time. I don't know about that specific tea, but they're ones that, you know, sound all healthy and everything. Mm-hmm. And you like look at it and like, oh, they've got barley in it. I can't have this. Some grains, which don't necessarily sound like they have gluten in them, like, couscous, that's a wheat product, wheat berry. Yeah. That's pretty much, you know, all gluten right there. Mm-hmm. But there are some other grains that sound like they probably do contain gluten that don't, like buckwheat. It's got wheat in the name, right? Well, no, yeah. it's not a wheat product at all. It's a completely different thing. So you can have that. You just end up having to be an excellent label reader. And then you kind of know what you can't have. No Twizzlers. Can't have a Twizzler. Stay away from the Twizzlers. Yeah. I don't know why there's gluten in there, but there is.
Exactly. I know sometimes on some of the things that I find I can relate to that with food allergies, I read a label and I'm like, why did you do that? Why didn't you people put this in here? But what about like shampoos and lotions and sunscreens or medicine?
Those are excellent. So let's start with medicine. So you actually, you know, put that in your mouth and swallow it. And that's, there are, for the most part, the active ingredients usually aren't gluten. That's like, no, but that's not a medicine for anything, but the excipients, the ingredients that, are the binder or the, you know, the other stuff that's in your pill might have, a gluten containing starch in there, gluten containing grain. And it's not very easy to suss that out. You can talk to your pharmacist to see if your medication has gluten in it. The challenge is that the excipients they get sourced from all over. The drug manufacturers, you know, get the best deal they can. At times they don't know what's in there. So gluten in medications is a big challenge, especially if you have to take a lot. You know, if you think about the total volume of gluten you would consume in one pill, it's probably not very much. It's probably, you know, there is a threshold under which you probably won't get sick. But if you're taking a handful of pills every day and they all have some sort of gluten in them, and you could be accidentally making yourself sick and not knowing it.
Especially if you're one of those that has a very low tolerance to being able to have any at all.
That's right. So that's one to, and if you, I've been taking this and then they move me to the generic or to the name, and I'm having symptoms I didn't have before, then that's a conversation with your doctor and your pharmacist to see, hey, we got to sort this out because I think I'm having a gluten reaction. I need a different solution in this med.
Don't be afraid to ask your doctor. Don't be afraid to ask the pharmacist.
That's right. And for topicals, this is, if it's something that you could ingest, if it's lipstick or lip balm or something that's near your mouth and you might be able to imagine swallowing it, that could be a challenge. The experts say, and this is, there are people in our community who absolutely react to, gluten in their topicals, in their shampoos or whatever. The researchers in the field say, unless it's entering through an open wound or something, the gluten cannot pass through your skin like that. It just doesn't happen that way. However, we hear this so much from our community that what I say is you have to listen to your body. And Beyond Celiac will say it's probably not a celiac reaction, but that doesn't mean you're not reacting. Mm-hmm. And it could be that more research will come out later and we'll come to know that, yes, that is a celiac reaction. It was just being misdiagnosed or mislabeled before. So, but there's, according to the experts, there's, you should be able to use the shampoo of your choice.
And be okay.
But if you react to it, do something different. I should note too that, oats. I should have mentioned this in the place where cross contact happens. Regular oats are kind of a danger zone for cross contact.
Okay.
And there are certified gluten-free oats out there that people with celiac disease should use instead of regular. That's one where they've really studied it and found that traditional oats in the way that they're grown and transported and processed are a hot spot for gluten contamination. There are also a fraction of the people with celiac disease react to oats the same way they react to gluten and can't have them at all. So that is also a real thing. So oats are kind of a special case in the celiac disease world.
Yeah. And my son, he's actually anaphylactic to oats.
Wow.
So, yeah. And we found that to be, I didn't realize how many things oat was in. even plain white bread. Yeah. So
yeah, that's a lot of people, a lot of people with celiac. So celiac disease, people, especially newly diagnosed with celiac disease may also be lactose intolerant, mm-hmm. at least until the gut heals. And then maybe, the dairy products can be reintroduced, but a lot of folks are sensitive to corn and corn products, and that's in everything.
Yes.
So it's just, there's no, if celiac disease meant that was the only thing that was wrong, then it's easier to manage than if you're a real human with other things mm-hmm. that you have to manage along with it. So.
Absolutely. Now what does Beyond Celiac do?
So
what does the organization do?
So we're a patient advocacy organization. And for us, that means we're advocating, we're making sure that the patient voice is included in all of the conversations out there, especially in research and clinical trials, advancing research for treatments and a cure. We do some government advocacy, but we're finding that we're able to make more of a contribution in the realm of making sure that the patient perspective is included in meaningful endpoints and research. And that means, is what they're studying actually going to benefit our community? Is it going to get us to being able to live our lives to the fullest? Sorry about that.
That's okay.
And along the way, we support our community in early diagnosis as early as possible to have the best long-term health benefits. I mentioned our small intestines don't necessarily put themselves back together like they were before. Earlier diagnosis will help that. We're learning through some research that we're funding out of the University of Sheffield in England that there is damage to our brains. I hate to call it brain damage, but there are structural changes that happen in our brains that don't repair like the gut does. And so the earlier we can get people diagnosed, the more likely we are to have positive outcomes in terms of, staving off some of those, dementia-like symptoms and challenges. So early diagnosis, early and accurate diagnosis, education for the world, support for our community, both in terms of how to manage celiac disease, but also, you know, the fun stuff of, you know, every Sunday night on our Facebook page, we have what's your best gluten-free find, and people around the country will share with us where they were able to find products or restaurants or recipes that just made them happy. They found it. It was good. They liked it. They shared it. So the patient support. And really, you know, we've planted a stake in the ground that we're going to accelerate research for treatments and a cure by 2030. And that's pretty aggressive. You know, if you know research and how quickly these things do or don't go, in 8 years, we've declared we will have some sort of treatment or cure for celiac disease. So as everything that we're doing, every decision we make as an organization is designed to get us to that goal as quickly as possible.
What are some of the most exciting, whether it be a clinical trial or research that's happening that's currently underway?
We have a really exciting diversity related project. We've partnered with the National Minority Quality Forum. And, you know, celiac disease is thought of as a white disease more than anything. And that it just doesn't line up with the reality of it. It's like most of the people who are diagnosed are white. And so we're working with the National Minority Quality Forum to create a celiac index, a map mapping the United States based on celiac disease claims based on demographics and location. And also those diseases or those things that could be signs of missed diagnosis and where they are, so that we've got a research project underway that noted that that anemia and IBS diagnosis in communities of color is prevalent where there is no celiac disease diagnosis. So I said that a little bit backwards, but
but it makes you wonder, is that really a celiac diagnosis going undiagnosed?
Right, exactly. So that one's very exciting. And we're doing our best to reach out and make a difference there. We also have a kind of a companion program called Voices of Celiac, where we're inviting people with celiac disease of all, you know, from anywhere in the United States and beyond, of any demographic background, to tell us their story and what their journey to diagnosis was like, and where there could have been missed opportunities for diagnosis. So, you know, for me, it was anemia forever and canker sores and that sort of thing. And so that's my story, but somebody else might have been told, you can't have celiac disease because Black people don't get celiac disease. And then they, you know, go on for several more years before they get diagnosed, that sort of thing.
And then come to find out they've done all this damage to their small intestine and they do have it.
Exactly. So there's that. And then we're funding research. I mentioned the research from University of Sheffield about with comparing brain scans, people with celiac disease and the difference in our brain structures to others, to really get a sense of what's going on systemically. We're doing research in the microbiome. What's different in our microbiome before, during, and after diagnosis and the gluten-free diet? How are our systems different? So that we can begin to repair, maybe even identify celiac disease before it turns all the way on. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting. So much good stuff. We're supporting clinical trials. There are several dozen drugs in the pipeline. We're actively supporting recruitment for several. So as much as we can help advance research for treatments and a cure, that's what we're working on.
Well, Claire, I just want to thank you so much for joining me today on the Food Allergy Talk podcast. I know I have learned a lot. I kind of felt like I had a basic, you know, understanding of what celiac was, but there was so much that honestly I didn't know. And I'm glad that I asked and that I know a little more now. So that way, you know, I can help others that I come across. Just for example, with the Rice Krispie treats, I would have admittedly thought that those were safe. You know, not realizing, hey, check the label and see if it says malt. So I know that I've learned a lot. If people want, go ahead.
And you can, not to interrupt you, but there are you know, store brand crispy rice cereals that don't have gluten in them.
Okay.
And Fruity Pebbles. I made some Fruity Pebbles.
Oh, we did Fruity Pebble treats. They're so good, aren't they?
Yeah, those are
they're almost great. Better.
They're so sweet, but they're very colorful.
Yes. Now, if people want to find Beyond Celiac online, where do they go? Where do they, if they're like, wow, I'd really like to share my story, like you were talking about people from different backgrounds. I want to share my story of diagnosis, or they want to donate, or whatever it is that they would like to do to become more connected with you and Beyond Celiac. How do they do that?
Our website's the best place, beyondceliac.org. Couldn't be easier. And from there, you'll find links to, you know, the donate button is right there. And under a tab, you know, life with celiac disease, you'll find the place where you can share your story, Voices of Celiac. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can sign up for the research news if you're very interested in that. We also have a patient registry called Go Beyond Celiac that you'd be able to sign up for. If you're interested in supporting us in a bigger way, go to beyondceliac.org/summerbeyond. We're doing a whole summer theme specifically to raise funds for three specific research projects that you can help with. So check us out. And on social media, Facebook, we're at, you know, Beyond Celiac, Instagram, Beyond Celiac, Twitter, Beyond Celiac. YouTube's a little funny, but mostly go to the other ones.
And they could probably even find it on the website, maybe.
Absolutely.
A link up to the YouTube.
Yep.
Well, that's so wonderful. Thank you so much. Be sure to follow Beyond Celiac on their website, beyondceliac.org, and related social media. This is the Food Allergy Talk podcast, where you can come to connect and leave uplifted, empowered, and ready for success.
I'm your host, Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI. Thanks for tuning in to the Food Allergy Talk podcast. Don't miss a future episode. Let's stay connected. Be sure to subscribe at iTunes, Spotify, Google, Amazon, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Pandora, TuneIn Alexa, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, and Reason FM. And until next time, remember, don't hesitate, investigate, and always carry two. This podcast is brought to you by the Everything Nut Allergy Cookbook, available now wherever books are sold. Details at foodallergypi.com.